and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a reaction to yesterday's overwhelming votes in the House and Senate to override President Obama's veto of JASTA, the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, that now is the law of the land, even though many senators who voted for it now want to amend the bill. Kristen Breitweiser, a 9/11 widow and activist who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on September the 11th, 2001, and in the months before, joins us to discuss why she feels that the role of the Saudis in the 9/11 attacks has not been thoroughly investigated, and that the only way the truth will finally come out is in court cases that can now go forward, in which discovery can be employed and evidence presented and evaluated. We will also discuss President Obama's rebuke of the Congress for not doing, quote, the hard thing in voting against JASTA. Then we'll speak with Philip Sheehan, a longtime Washington correspondent and foreign correspondent for The New York Times and the best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. He joins us to discuss the concerted efforts following the release of the declassified 28 pages to close the book on 9/11 and ignore the paths not taken by previous investigators that the pages reveal, indicating the leads generated in evidence trails were not followed because higher-ups blocked the pursuit of any investigation into Saudi Arabia's possible role in 9/11. We will also assess whether today's announcement that Saudi Arabia is cutting production to drive up the price of oil, which will take the pressure off Russia's sinking economy, is retaliation for yesterday's vote, assuming the U.S. has been encouraging Saudi Arabia to flood the market to lower the price of oil as a way to punish Putin. Then finally, Lisa Campbell joins us in the studio. She is a 20-year veteran of law enforcement who comes from a family in which her mother, father, brother, uncles, and cousins are police officers. We will discuss the documentary film she has just finished, Shoot, Don't Shoot, which attempts to bridge the gap by addressing the underlying issues that lead to the escalation of violence by and against the police. Since new evidence is emerging from both the controversial shootings of Keith Scott in Charlotte and Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, we will examine non-lethal options that police could employ and whether they are trained and equipped to deal with the erratic behavior of suspects suffering from mental illness or drug addiction. And joining us now is Kristen Breitweiser, who is a 9/11 widow and activist who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on the morning of September 11th and in the months leading up to it. She testified before the Joint Inquiry of Congress in September of 2002 and the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee in August of 2004 with regard to national security reforms. She has an article at the Huffington Post, Obama is blocking the path to justice for 9/11 victims' families. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kristen Breitweiser.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And of course, the article that you wrote has been eclipsed by the dramatic events yesterday in the House and Senate. The Senate overrode President Obama's veto of the bill that would allow 9/11 families to sue the government of Saudi Arabia, were 97-1, and the House, it was 334-78. So that was quite a dramatic rebuke, I guess, the first veto that the president has suffered. How did it strike you?
I mean, obviously, you know, we're pleased to be one step closer to justice for the 3,000 people killed on 9/11, but we acknowledge that there's a long road ahead, and already we're hearing talks by various members of Congress questioning and raising concerns. Specifically, Senator Bob Corker apparently spoke to the Saudi Foreign Minister Al Jabir and has mentioned in the press that he wants to please the Saudis by, quote-unquote, tweaking the language of the law that was passed yesterday. I mean, I don't really know why a U.S. senator is looking to please a foreign official with language in a United States piece of legislation, but nonetheless, this is the type of thing that the 9/11 families have had to deal with in our ongoing fight to get justice for the murder of 3,000 people.
And the bill we're talking about, which was co-sponsored by Senators Schumer and Cornyn, the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, again passed overwhelmingly yesterday, but no sooner had it passed than 28 senators signed a letter asking for improvements to the bill after they'd voted on it, and Schumer said, no way. So what explains that? I mean,
I think what explains it is that the Saudis hired four new lobbying firms earlier in the week, and that explains why, at least I could say, Senator Corker is so very concerned about needing to, quote-unquote, tweak the language to please the Saudis. I mean, there's no denying the fact that these new lobbyists were in the offices of the senators. I know as a fact at least two of them who signed that letter, because the other widows were sitting in the same office and saw Trent Lott walk out of them. So, you know, it goes to show that the Saudi money is well spent in Washington and well targeted.
Well, apparently the lead lobbyist for the Saudis is the brother of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta.
I didn't know that he was the lead. I do know that the Saudis have, I think, 8 or 10 very prominent lobbying firms in Washington working on their behalf. And again, all I would say is, you know, I'm against lobbyists to begin with, but I certainly have a problem when U.S. elected officials and even my president is crafting legislation to please the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, particularly when, in my opinion, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia played a strong hand in the murder of my husband and 3,000 others. I don't particularly understand why, in my opinion, the criminal enterprise is given a voice in writing this legislation.
So is this then to suggest, Kristen Breitwiser, that the senators and the House members wanted it sort of both ways? On the one hand, they want to placate you and the other families of the 9/11 victims, recognizing that you've become a very influential lobby on the one hand, but on the other hand, they want to sort of now try and weasel out of it?
Absolutely not. I think what this is a small handful of senators, specifically on the Foreign Relations Committees, that are taking orders from Saudis. I mean, it's no different than when back in February we had a story that the Saudis were threatening, you know, to bankrupt the U.S. economy if this legislation passed. This is about U.S. elected officials giving sway and bowing towards the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And it's unconscionable. And that's why we are extremely grateful to all of the members of Congress who are not persuaded by the kingdom and who are interested in justice and want to see, you know, accountability for the murder of 3,000 people on the September 11th attacks 15 years ago. And again, I mean, this is a handful of elected officials who are unfortunately incredibly swayed by the vast lobbying network of the Saudis. And it's unfortunate, it's unconscionable, but, you know, that is why that letter was written, and that is why there's even a discussion of it today. And it has certainly nothing to do with the merits of the law. JASTA is a very smart, very well thought out, debated, it had hearings, long history in both the House and the Senate. This is not some fly-by-night piece of legislation that, you know, was thrown in at 3 o'clock in the morning and voted on. This legislation's been around for 7 years. They've had hearings on it. And, you know, again, what you're seeing right now is not anything other than the impact that Saudi money has in lobbying our elected officials.
There is an article in the Huffington Post today by their foreign affairs reporter. The title of the article is, "The Saudi 9/11 bill is a gross stunt that empowers conspiracy theorists. Congress is perpetuating lies and damaging U.S. foreign policy at a moment when that's really, really unhelpful." So what explains that kind of conflation, if you will, with the work that you have done? And it's clearly got the attention of the House and Senate with these vast majorities of votes. And the sort of 9/11 truthers out there on the fringes who sort of don't have a life and kind of make up crazy stuff. So
I can't speak about the whatever you said, the 9/11 truthers out on the fringe. What I can tell you is that anyone and everyone who has spoken out against this legislation has a conflict of interest. Whether you want to talk about the companies that came forward, General Electric, Boeing, Dow, and Chevron, you know, each of those companies has had multi-billion dollar contracts with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia within the last year. Boeing literally 48 hours ago signed a contract for 28 planes with the KSA, $8 billion. General Electric, $3 billion deal. Dow Chemical, $20 billion chemical plant in the KSA. Those companies, they all have a self-interest. The individuals that signed the letter opposing JASTA, Michael Mukasey's last lobbying job was for MEC, the Iranian terrorist regime. Okay? Michael Mukasey is no one you want to defer to when, you know, he's getting paid for his opinion. Two of the other individuals on the letter opposing JASTA, both literally on the board of directors of an organization directly funded by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and its embassy in Washington. The other person, Richard Clark, is responsible for the Saudi flights and exodus on the, you know, days after 9/11. The other individual was responsible, Michael Morrell, was responsible for the creation of the August 6 PDB that, you know, mentioned bin Laden determined to strike in the United States. So when you look at all of these people that are speaking out about this legislation, every single one of them has got a conflict of interest. Every single one of them has a reason to not want 9/11 investigated or not want the Saudis held accountable. And that's why I'm on your show right now, because the American public needs to know the truth.
And will they get the truth via a lawsuit? That, I understand, is in many ways the point of this legislation, that the assumption is that the investigations so far have not gone far enough, and only in a lawsuit will all of these issues be aired and judged and adjudicated.
That's exactly it. The U.S. government has had, you know, 15 years to investigate this adequately, and they failed to do the job. Whether you want to talk about the joint inquiry that got shut down because the FBI didn't cooperate and President Bush wasn't exactly enthusiastic about an investigation into the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia when he wanted to invade Iraq, or whether you want to talk about the 9/11 commission that was compromised because its staff director didn't want the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia investigated. You know, the reality is the 9/11 families just want their day in court. We want to have a discovery process where all of this information and evidence can be gathered and looked at and considered in an unbiased, full fashion so that we can have some accountability with regard to the murder of 3,000 people.
And can you tie this overwhelming vote to the very thing that you just said, which is, you know, the apologists now are saying, well, you know, this has been thoroughly investigated, and there's no there. And yet the vast majority of the United States Congress, which rarely agrees on anything, have voted in favor of what amounts to a reinvestigation of 9/11. Isn't that the simple facts?
Precisely the fact. And the reality is, again, I challenge anyone who has a problem with JASTA, look into their background, and I guarantee you that they've got some sort of conflict of interest in that they either don't want the 9/11 attacks investigated or they don't want the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia investigated. It's one of those two things. There is no one else speaking out about this legislation who does not have a conflict of interest. And to me, that's why Congress passed it with such an overwhelming majority, because Congress knows that. Congress knows that every single person who's got a problem with JASTA, you know, has got a half-baked, self-serving interest. And it's deplorable, frankly. You know, the bottom line is there is ample evidence connecting the Saudis to the 9/11 attacks. That evidence should be further investigated, and it should be presented to the American public. And the Saudis should be held accountable. And frankly, if they've done nothing wrong, then what are they so worried about? If they've done nothing wrong, why did they hire 10 lobbying firms to protect themselves?
Well,
is that the behavior of someone who's not worried about what could be found out?
Well, what I find extraordinary, though, is that when the 28 pages were released, the attitude in much of the press was, well, you know, now it's all over. And if you read the 28 pages and if you read the previous field notes of the FBI and CIA investigators that were declassified before the 28 pages, you realize that what we're talking about here are all of these leads that were developed. But what nobody says is the leads weren't followed. They were blocked from going any further. That's, to me, is what the real heart of the story is and where the real smoking gun is. Do you agree with that to begin with?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why, frankly, 15 years later, I'm still out fighting, because the information needs to be investigated and we need to get some answers. And more than anything, I think what's going to happen is that when this information is brought forward, when the American public sees it, there's going to be some very uncomfortable, difficult, pointed questions brought to our government in that, why have we considered this country our ally for the last 15 years? Because make no mistake, certain people in our government know full well all about this information. And yet, they've ignored it, they've turned a blind eye for 15 years.
And, but
so,
yeah,
there's going to be a lot of explaining to do, which would explain, again, why there are a handful of people that are opposed to this legislation and made very uncomfortable by it.
But what about in a court case, which I imagine is the whole purpose of moving forward now, to be able to sue Saudi Arabia or the government or whatever entity it is that we're looking into here? Would you be able to get anybody extradited or to show up in court?
I can't answer that. What I can tell you is the very next step is discovery. And, you know, the lawyers will be in court requesting documents and evidence. And under discovery rules, they have to get it. So I think that that's going to be an extremely enlightening phase. And we very much look forward to it. And certainly, we hope no one in Congress would try to put a stop to that. As it stands right now, JASTA is the law of the land. Unfortunately, like I said in the beginning of the conversation, there are a handful of individuals who have a very large self-interest in making sure JASTA does not remain law as it is written currently. And I certainly hope that the American public will stay awake and aware and fully engaged on the issue so that no senator is able to slide anything into any piece of legislation that will gut or walk back any of the language in JASTA.
Well, just in closing, Kristen Breitweiser, the president, of course, made a statement yesterday and said that he was doing the hard thing and everybody else who voted in favor of JASTA were doing the easy thing. And as we know, the Saudis have always concentrated their money on the executive branch and hired former defense, intelligence, State Department officials, giving them sort of bogus jobs for enormous amounts of money. That is a pattern in Washington. But what would you say to the arguments that the president made, one of which, of course, is that this opens a can of worms in terms of reciprocity, where American corporations, individuals, and military personnel could be exposed to foreign lawsuits?
To be perfectly blunt, the president is being disingenuous with the American public with that argument. And, you know, the reality is all of our diplomats and soldiers are protected by the Vienna Convention. There will be absolutely no floodgates open for foreign lawsuits. And the White House's argument is just plain wrong. And anyone can go look that up, again, the Vienna Convention. And you'll see that the White House is being completely disingenuous. And the only other thing I could say is it's going to be one hell of a library in Chicago.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Kristen Breitweiser.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Kristen Breitweiser, who's a 9/11 widow and activist who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on the morning of September 11th and in the months leading up to it. She testified before the Joint Inquiry of Congress in September 2002 and the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee in August of 2004 with regard to national security reforms. She has an article at the Huffington Post, Obama is blocking the path to justice for 9/11 victims' families. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the concerted efforts to close the book on 9/11. That you want me to do. Yes, you have, girl.
Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me doing everything crazy that you want me to do. Get your hair, yeah, watch it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Philip Sheenan, who's a best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported for more than 60 countries and several war zones. His latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Sheenan.
Ian, thank you.
And with the overwhelming vote on just the bill that would allow the 9/11 families to sue Saudi Arabia, 97-1 in the Senate, 338-74, I think it was, in the House, it's now the law of the land. But the premise here is that the families need their day in court because of the need for discovery, and the assumption is that the 9/11 Commission so far and the Joint Commission headed up by Bob Graham in the House and Senate and the release of the 28 pages and the release of the field notes prior to that are not sufficient, that the story still hasn't been told. Do you accept that premise?
I think that's true. I mean, what the situation has been for several years now is that there is a tremendous amount of evidence that is on the public record, and I say it's been there for years, showing that at least some element of the Saudi government, people at lower levels, particularly in Southern California, were involved in some sort of support network for two of the hijackers who lived openly in Southern California in the year before the attacks. And I think the families feel they now have the opportunity to go to court and make the argument that at least some part of the Saudi government had some responsibility for 9/11 and should be punished and held liable as a result.
Well, already there are stories, for example, in the Huffington Post by their foreign affairs reporter, the title of which is "The Saudi 9/11 Bill is a Gross Stunt that Empowers Conspiracy Theories. Congress is Perpetuating Lies and Damaging U.S. Foreign Policy at an Important Moment When That's Really, Really Unhelpful." And then you've got 28 senators now sort of having buyer's remorse, and McConnell is talking about revisiting the bill, etc. So is this a tactic then to conflate the 9/11 families? We just spoke a minute ago with Kristen Breitweiser that there's some, you know, they're trying to conflate those 9/11 truther conspiracies with this ongoing effort to get the truth about 9/11. Is that the latest, for the want of a better description, smear?
I think to some extent it is. You know, people have, there are conspiracies and there are conspiracies. 9/11, it just so happens, was a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy designed by Al-Qaeda to attack the United States. And there does appear to have been some element of the Saudi government that was involved in supporting those terrorists before they carried out their plot. And that full story has never been told. In fact, people have read official investigations of 9/11 as, for some reason, exonerating Saudi Arabia, when many people believe the Saudis do not deserve to be exonerated. They need to be investigated for what participation they may have had in the terrorist attack. And it's interesting to talk to the former 9/11 commissioners who themselves want this investigation and are themselves concerned that anybody is reading the evidence as exonerating the Saudis. They think the Saudis deserve further investigation.
Well, there's a very interesting article in the New York Review of Books, "In Saudi Arabia, Can It Really Change?" And it sort of explores this relationship, this bifurcation between the House of Saud, which is ostensibly the government. It's a family government. And the Wahhabi sect that is arguably used by the royal family to keep the people in line because it's they regulate, for the one to put it mildly, a very oppressive form of religion. So if you're basically spending all your time wondering whether you're showing a wisp of hair under your burqa, then you don't have time to think about revolution. And the Wahhabis were empowered even further, apparently, after the mosque attack in Jeddah at the main mosque. I think it was in 1979. So that there's a kind of ambiguous relationship here between the Al Sauds, who put all their money in the West and have sent out their urbane foreign minister to make arguments in favor of the Saudi government and against this bill just passed in the Senate. But then you have the Saudi Ministry of Islamic Affairs, which is the sort of government's part that sends the Wahhabis around the world. And a part of the evidence that came out of Southern California that was in the 28 pages was involved with the Saudi-financed Wahhabi mosque in Culver City, where the head of that mosque was also one of the suspects. So there you have, in that person, you have the embodiments of this bifurcation.
Exactly. And you raise the questions about the Saudi Ministry of Islamic Affairs. That is what needs to be investigated. Many of these lawyers and the families will tell you that there was an element of the Saudi government, but maybe in large part the Saudi government was cooperative against terrorism before 9/11. Maybe it was on board with the United States in trying to prevent attacks in the United States and elsewhere. But what happens if there was an element of the Saudi government, in this case the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, that was indeed involved in supporting terrorism and supporting in particular hijackers in the United States before 9/11? And what happens if we never got to the bottom of what the Ministry of Islamic Affairs was up to? And the families will tell you, and the lawyers representing the families will tell you, is they now they have the opportunity to really pursue an aggressive investigation as to whether or not the Ministry of Islamic Affairs was tied to the terrorist attacks and whether or not the Saudi government isn't liable for some of the damages done by those people as a result.
But then the other big looming question, surely, though, Phil Sheenan, is what possible motive would the Saudis have? And that kind of does have people scratching their head. The best motive that so far that I can see and understand and grasp, particularly if you follow through on the idea that this was more to do with the Saudi Ministry of Islamic Affairs and therefore Wahhabism, would be the kind of apocalyptic nature of the Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, which is extremely austere. And it's a part of it is this notion of takfir, which is in a religious exemption to kill non-believers. And that seems to be that sort of apocalyptic wing that the Islamic State, Boko Haram, the Taliban, and al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, you name it, all of these terrorist organizations that have sprung up seem to be all inspired to one degree or another by takfir. So is that an explanation or the beginning of an explanation, shall I say, that the only thing that makes sense is a kind of apocalyptic religious zeal that would inform the reasons why the attacks were taking place?
Well, in terms of the Saudi government's responsibility, I think I'm no theologian, but from what I've read, it sounds like the Saudi royal family and senior elements, civilian elements of the government, were concerned about the survival of their own regime and essentially supported the Ministry of Islamic Affairs and the Wahhabi branch of Islam as a way of sort of buying them off of, you know, better to have them attack outside Saudi Arabia than have them make trouble within Saudi Arabia. And that resulted in large charitable, what were described as charitable contributions by elements of the Saudi royal family and the government to these charities that have been involved in terrorism all around the world.
So is that to say then that there's a strategy of being both the arsonist and the fire brigade?
I think that's put well, yes. And yes, I think that's what's going on. And that is the concern about what happened before 9/11. Was the Saudi government, in an effort to buy its own survival, supporting elements of Islam operating overseas, and in particular the Ministry of Islamic Affairs operating overseas, that were involved in terrorism. And I think very bluntly, if you look at the facts of what happened in Southern California, it's very clear that Saudi nationals on the payroll of the Saudi government were tasked to help the hijackers after they got to the United States. That's a very troubling discovery. And the families of 9/11 victims, you would think, would have the right to get to the bottom of what those people were up to.
Well, but there's been evidence for the longest time that the two hijackers down in San Diego received funding from the wife of the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar. And it was revealed in the 28 pages that were, you know, kept secret for the longest time, that Bandar's bodyguard at his estate in Aspen, Colorado, was in phone contact with these same hijackers.
I've read the same evidence you have. I find it pretty startling and alarming, and I've been amazed that more people don't see it the same way, that so many people seem eager to exonerate the Saudis for any potential involvement in this.
But the reason that this is still an open wound, surely, and certainly Christian Breitwiser was still very passionate and dismissing much of what's happening now as simply the deployment of massive amounts of Saudi Arabian money into Washington through these public relations firms, like the one that's headed by the head of Hillary Clinton's campaign's brother, the Podesta Company. So that's her explanation. But my sense is that, again, you get back to what those 28 pages were and what the previous release of the field notes were about, and that is investigations that weren't followed through. Is there any evidence that any of those investigations, did anybody, for example, ever talk to Prince Bandar's bodyguard and ask him why he was talking to these two hijackers?
Well, I'll tell you that there is a transcript of an interview with Prince Bandar conducted by the 9/11 Commission that remains to this day classified for reasons I don't fully understand. It's sitting at the National Archives, but apparently Bandar was asked some of these questions, responded to them, and that's still being denied to you and me and the rest of the public and the 9/11 families. And perhaps one of the results of what happened yesterday in Congress is that perhaps the lawyers representing the families will get to find out what explanation Bandar had for those money transfers and for these contacts between people at the Saudi embassy in Washington and Al-Qaeda.
But that takes the theory that the only explanation for why this would happen would be, we know what bin Laden's motives were for sure, but if there was help, if bin Laden was in any way helped, and particularly through the Saudi Ministry of Islamic Affairs, then you have to try and understand the weird sort of religious apocalyptic nature of that kind of motivation. But if Bandar's involved, he represents the Al Saud family. He was often called Bandar Bush because of his close relationship to the Bush family. That's a whole different matter, isn't it? That takes it out of the Ministry of Islamic Affairs into the House of Saud itself.
I agree with you, but I say we don't really know the answer to that. And it has been argued to me, you know, we do have these money transfers from Princess Haifa, who's the wife of Prince Bandar, that ends up in San Diego, possibly ends up in the hands of the hijackers. We now know from the 28 or 29 pages that money may have gone from Prince Bandar himself to San Diego. But I've also heard it argued that really Prince Bandar and Princess Haifa don't know much about this, and essentially they signed checks that were put in front of them by people who worked at the Ministry of Islamic Affairs. The prince and his wife were told these were charitable contributions when, in fact, they were not. They were going to be used for nefarious reasons. But that's being offered to me by people who are sympathetic to the plight of to Bandar and his wife. But let's get to the facts. Now the lawyers representing the families will have the chance to pursue what it is that caused money from the ambassador in Washington to finish up in the hands of people supporting the hijackers.
And what about the fellow, though, that facilitated the entry of these two hijackers through Customs and Immigration at Los Angeles International Airport, who then later had ties to the bombers of the coal in Yemen? My understanding is that had those leads been tracked down, 9/11 itself could have been prevented. You know, we know from, for example, Colleen Rowley, the FBI agent who wanted to investigate Zachariah Moussaoui because he was learning how to fly jumbo jets but not how to land them. She was one of those sort of loose threads, if you will, that indicated a lack of interest in pursuing these leads earlier. But given, you know, if you can excuse the kind of blind culture of the FBI, perhaps, because this was a hard thing to get your head around, that people would do this. But it seems to me that that particular part of the 28 pages is a real smoking gun.
Well, I say that one of the great mysteries about 9/11, certainly in terms of the investigation by the 9/11 Commission, is how is it possible that the Central Intelligence Agency was aware quite early, I think it was in 2000, of the fact that these two hijackers were in the United States and did not share that information, and knew they were linked to Al-Qaeda and never shared that information until the very last minute with the FBI. Because you have to believe if our government had been doing its job properly, if the CIA and the FBI had been cooperating, if the FBI had known that these two Al-Qaeda terrorists were in the United States, were in San Diego, they would have been rolled up, and perhaps 9/11 itself might have been avoided. What happened in San Diego, it's Moussaoui and elsewhere. There were plenty of opportunities to stop 9/11 from happening, yet it went forward in large part because of the incompetence of our own government.
Well, it's still pretty extraordinary to think that a Saudi official could walk these hijackers around customs and immigration to have that kind of privilege. That is in itself something that boggles the mind, frankly. And then it turns out...
The Saudi government for generations now has had special... They've been treated with great care by the United States government. They still are treated with great care by the United States government, both because of their strategic importance in the Middle East to the United States and, of course, because of their oil riches, which have been so important in supplying energy to the United States over generations now.
Well, just in closing, though, is there a coincidence, the fact that just as the JASTA bill becomes law, which the Saudis opposed vehemently and have spent a fortune on PR to try and stop, now that it's the law of the land, what happens? The price of oil suddenly goes up. The Saudis decide to stop flooding the market and in league, even helping Iran and Russia. And so is that possible retaliation? It's obviously the U.S. is happy to see Putin being curtailed by low oil prices, but it looks like that deal, if it's a Saudi-U.S. deal, is off now.
I suppose so. You have to remember, though, that at the end of the day, the Saudis need us more than we need them, especially in an era in which the United States is able to supply much of its own energy needs now. The Saudis, without American military support, without a certain economic relationship, you know, that government cannot survive. And I think that has to be factored into whatever the Saudis plan on doing.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Philip Sheehan.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Sheehan, who's the best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries and several war zones. His latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. We're going to take a brief station break and back addressing the underlying issues that lead to the escalation of violence by and against the police.
Something would say you want to go and do your in, cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining me now in the studio is Lisa Campbell, who has served 20 years in law enforcement and comes from a family in which her mother, father and brother, uncles and cousins are police officers. She has worked in jails, courts and the streets and has worked investigations and conducted background investigations for the Los Angeles Police Department. Born and raised on the south side of Chicago, she grew up amid a culture infested with gangs and gang violence and offers a unique and raw perspective on the political impact of policing. She is currently finishing a film called Shoot, Don't Shoot, a documentary that attempts to bridge the gap by addressing the underlying issues that have led to the escalation of violence by and against the police in urban communities like Chicago. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Campbell.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we spoke before. It's good to see you in person, Lisa. And, you know, there have been two big incidents that have got a lot of coverage. The Terrence Crutcher shooting by the Tulsa police officer who's now been charged with first-degree manslaughter. And then, of course, the other shooting in Charlotte that has also gotten a lot of attention, the killing of Keith Scott in Charlotte, which I think most of our listeners have seen the extraordinarily dramatic video of his wife who was there capturing much of it on the cell phone. But subsequently, you know, I reported both of these incidents at the time, but there's been some new information coming out about the backgrounds of the people that were shot. And obviously, you're not trying. I mean, they've already paid the ultimate penalty. So nobody's in the business of wanting to trash anybody who has been killed. And pretty clear with the case in Tulsa that since the police officer's been charged with first-degree manslaughter, then there's no justifying that. So we don't want to punish people unnecessarily. But there is more coming out, shall I say. So, and this leads me to, I think, the fair assessment is that both victims were troubled, but that doesn't justify what happened to them. And the fact that the police shot them, I'm not justifying the Tulsa shooting because that seems to be unjustified. But the other shooting in Charlotte, there's some ambiguity. But the point I want to raise here and talk to you about, Lisa, is it seems like when the police have to confront people that have trouble pass and drug problems, you invariably get in a situation where you really need the intervention of somebody with psychiatric training as opposed to police training. And that seems to be what leads to these tragedies. So let's start from that premise.
You know, first we have to acknowledge that policing is a very challenging job in and of itself. So we then couple that with the escalating rise in mental health disorders, the proliferation of guns, and all of the things that an officer is combating on a day-to-day basis. So let's just start there. The suggestion that the mental health crisis in America has become an epidemic, and we have police officers that are not trained to deal with that. So it's clearly they're not psychologists, social workers, and they don't have the training background and experience in most cases. So that is something that, again, and it goes back to me always saying the political impact. It goes back to something that the higher-ups need to take a look at. There are some agencies, I think that Berkeley, California is one of them, I think that they've implemented that process where there are mental health techs that go out on calls. I think that you can look at hiring officers that have a background or sending officers to school, because many departments pay for education. And so that when you have a call of someone who that may be mentally disturbed, there's an officer on that watch trained to respond to that call. To expect the police to be perfect at all time, it's such a delicate balance. Snap second decisions, judgment calls, life experience. Life experience. So when we talk about really the Black Lives Movement, we talk about all lives, because if you've got officers out there, black or white, that don't have the experience with dealing with people and de-escalating and diffusing a situation, we'll see more and more of that because fear sets in first. And when people are fearful, they respond in fear.
Well, in the case of the Keith Scott shooting in Charlotte, the policeman who shot him was African-American. I think they gave him 12 commands to drop the gun. A gun has surfaced in evidence, plus a ankle holster. But, of course, North Carolina is also a open carry state. I mean, that's a part of the problem, surely. But again, you get back to, why do you have to shoot people? Now, I understand if somebody's got a gun and doesn't want to put it down, that's a different matter. And there's certainly not, there's no evidence in the Crutcher case in Tulsa that he had any gun. In fact, he had his hands up. And he was tasered before he was shot. So this leads me to the obvious. Why aren't there more non-lethal ways to neutralize people?
Again, I think those are the tough questions that have to be asked. I think that, you know, I hear a lot that it goes back to training. Well, there are many levels.
What about equipment then?
There are many levels. So it's really hard to second judge a police officer unless you've been in that police officer's shoes. That's why it's hard to get a conviction, even if you get an indictment, because if that officer can articulate imminent fear of great bodily harm or death, then they're justified in the use of deadly force. So what that may be for you at the time of that scenario may be very different from me based on my life experience, based on my training, skills, background, where I grew up, what community I came from. So we have to start getting to the underlying issues before we, you know, why are some more prone to go to the weapon? Now, hear me. Police officers want to go home safe every day. But what we want to ensure is that we have police officers out on the street that have good judgment. The problem is that it's like any, unlike any other profession, when a police officer is wrong, it's dead wrong. The officer is dead or they kill somebody else. And that's not to say good officers every day go out with the best intentions. But things get really quick out there and things happen so fast that you only have the judgment based on your perception, which is your reality in that moment. And so I say that to say that you're not really trained. So I'm not deflecting accountability, because I believe that the safety of good officers is deeply rooted in the accountability of the bad officers. In other words, if there's a criminal out there that does wrong, he or she should go to jail. And if there's a cop out there doing wrong, he or she should go to jail. But I think it comes to intention. Did that officer intend to do the right thing? And did they use the tools that they were given? So then your question is, why are there not more or less than lethal force weapons out there? Well, I don't know if there are or are not. What we should be asking is, why is there such an escalation in the uptick? And why does it appear that some people go to deadly force first? It seems to me that in the case particularly of Crutcher, that he was tasered. That is a less than lethal. So why there was an immediate shot to follow, I don't know. But those are the questions that...
Right, and that may well be why the officer was charged with first-degree manslaughter.
And what is the level of fear that's reasonable for that officer? So one of the things that I wanted to say is that we have to get away from the unarmed person theory being unjustified. And I'm not justifying or not justifying either one of these. I think we have to let the case unfold. But just because somebody doesn't have a weapon doesn't mean that they don't place you in imminent fear of great bodily harm or death, or that they're not able to cause serious injury to somebody. I think what you want to say is nonviolent, non-aggressive. So what we saw was somebody walking away with their hands up. And so a reasonable person would say that the threat had diminished. He was no longer following voice commands. So I think what we have to do in the law enforcement community is train on a de-escalation. How important is it? I mean, what was the nature of that call? The call was a stranded vehicle or vehicle stuck in the middle of the road. Is that something that somebody has to die over?
Right. And he was already prejudged by the helicopter policeman who said, that's a bad dude. And as it happened, the guy that's sitting next to him is the husband of the officer who was charged with manslaughter.
You know, it's definitely a culture that thinks alike and respond alike. And right, and some of that is good because your survival depends on it. I think that we really have to really look at who we're hiring, why we're hiring, how we're hiring. We have to look at the tools we give them to be effective. Police are scared today. You know, we just finished wrapping up a component of the film, and we did a lot of interviews. And we interviewed chiefs of police. We interviewed police officers who can't speak because they are, they're sworn under oath and they can't speak to the public. It has to have a representative. So you don't hear it, which is why I don't mind speaking, because you don't hear it from the officers. Yeah. But today officers are terrified because they have the damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't mentality. And it's one of the few jobs in the world where you could go set out to do the best job today and you're indicted tonight. because you made a mistake. So I don't know. You know, we have to look at the intention. We have to look at the skill level, who's being put in what community and why. You know, we had a lot of feedback from people saying, listen, we want more police that look like us because they understand us. So if you're coming from a community where you can't identify with the issues I'm dealing with on a day-to-day basis, that immediately presents challenges in how you're going to deal with me. By the same token, the community has to also understand that these officers are high stress today. You know, officers are dying just as fast as people are dying. When you have the Dallas, you have the Baton Rouge shooting, you have police officers that are on edge.
Right.
So it goes both ways. So we've got to find solutions that bridge the gap, right? So we understand and see each other.
And that's what your film's about,
right? That's about it, is bridging the gap so that we can one.
Shoot, don't shoot.
Shoot, don't shoot is a documentary that bridges the gap between police and the community so that we can create these dialogues, right? We can get into a room and say, hey, listen, we have these issues culturally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we haven't always been on the right side of justice in law enforcement. By the same token, this tension and this anger that people of color have at us naturally has also been passed down.
Sure.
And so when we start looking at those issues, we'll start to understand why we see more of the knee-jerk reactions that we're starting to see.
So again, in the Terrence Crutcher case in Tulsa, the police say that there was a vial of PCP. He had a pretty substantial arrest record. One of the arrests, his father told the police that his son had a problem with PCP. The reports were that he was turning his life around. And again, the fact that the officer has been charged with first-degree manslaughter indicates that the shooting was, at least to me, that the shooting was not justified, although clearly if the PCP was a factor, then he probably was acting strange. But acting strange is certainly not reason for a death sentence. In the other case, the dramatic video that the wife took, she does say, you know, she's warning the police not to shoot, not to shoot. He doesn't have a gun. He doesn't have a gun. He has TBI, traumatic brain injury. Apparently he did. He had a motorcycle accident. And then he supposedly, Keith Scott had never been the same after that. But then she said, don't do it, don't do it. I don't know what that was referring to.
So there's a conflict right there, right?
Yeah.
Even if you're the officer on that scene right now, you have to first of all imagine, if you can, and most people can't, the adrenaline that's going through the officer at that point, because the belief was there was a gun. And drop it.
There were 12 commands to drop the gun.
And so after that, you already know that you're not dealing with a reasonable situation, because the average person or the reasonable situation would comply.
Right.
So there's escalating stress in the officer's adrenaline in his body. So they're hearing, even if they were listening to her, let's just say for a second, that her commands were conflicting as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know, it gets really complicated. And we'd all like to Monday night quarterback and say, well, you shouldn't or you should. You know, I can honestly say that if I'm in a scenario where I'm, what is the threat level? We're always assessing the threat level. But I'm in imminent fear of great bodily harm or death. I'm asking someone to drop a weapon. They don't drop a weapon. Drop the weapon. And we don't know the particulars. Was it pointed? Was it, you know, we don't know the particulars. That investigation is still going. But they're going to more than likely be justified in the use of deadly force.
Right.
So, I mean, but then you also have to say, well, there are the mental health issues. Maybe he wasn't processing. Maybe he didn't hear it. But those are the things that are still...
Right.
You can, you know, they're irrelevant at this point because the officers in that moment have to react to what they feel threatened by in that instance. And I'm not justifying saying this officer was right or wrong. I'm just trying to paint the scenario of what goes through the officer's minds, the psyche, when they're on that call. And people will say, well, they rushed to jump. The other side to that, and I'm not saying that they don't. Clearly, we're looking at the Crutcher versus the Scott case, you know, there were the thoughts that it was a book that he had.
Right.
But then when she's saying, don't do it, don't do what?
Yeah.
Don't do it. The officer cannot afford for him to do it or not do it, to make that decision.
Right.
So it gets really tricky in those snap second judgment calls. It really does, because if they're wrong, they're dead wrong.
Right.
And so how do we, you know, I tell my nephews and relatives, listen, you're not going to win this scenario no matter what right here. If the officer asks you to do something, if they're being jerks or if they're out of pocket, comply. Get a name, get a badge number, but comply with them so that you live to talk about it. Because today we're not living through incidents that we should be writing paper on and sending people home. So,
well, you know, there was, of course, a Colt Series 80 Mustang 380 caliber pistol recovered at the scene, at least that's what we're told. And the very fact that they market guns with names like Mustang, which is, you know, like a fast car, that brings up the other issue, and you mentioned it in passing, the gun culture. And that, of course, is what's afflicting Chicago. And all of those gang kids that are getting shot on a daily basis. I don't know whether you saw the incredibly upsetting footage of the young gang kid filming himself, talking to his mother. And while he's literally standing on a street corner doing a selfie, live video, talking to his mother, he's shot.
Yeah, Chicago is a
But those
a jungle.
Guns come from...
The proliferation of guns. They're not bringing them in here.
Yeah, they come from Indiana, don't they?
Well, they're coming from all over. But, I mean, when we think about it, you really, again, and I stay with this, you have to hold the politicians accountable, right? Because that's where all your funding is coming from. That's who you vote for during the election times will determine the governor, will determine the mayor, will determine the superintendent of your schools, the chiefs of your police, how those resources go out to your community. So if you're not voting smart, then you're then either going to be part of this problem or just sit still and take it because you didn't become active. But police culture will change when we get better politicians appointing better police chiefs and chiefs that can do the job that they are hired to do.
But just in closing, your film, Shoot, Don't Shoot, what kind of job do you want it to do?
Shoot, Don't Shoot, I want it to be impactful. You know, listen, we just submitted it to Sundance last Friday, this short, and we're just hoping that, it, you know what, if we can create an impact that says, wow, I never thought about it that way, and teach somebody, be it a police officer or a citizen, how to survive an encounter or not even have a deadly encounter. That's the goal of the film.
And do you think that, I mean, it sounds like something that one of the things that upsets a lot of people in the African American community is you have to do that. You have to teach your kids not to be provocative anyway. And there is a double standard. You know, in the white community, you're not told, you know, keep your hands visible at all times. I do it because instinct. But
you're
you
right. Well, it goes back to the historical legacy. Black lives were not valued. Law enforcement they serve and protect other communities and often just police our communities. And that's not to say that we don't have some of the underlying issues that fuel the uptick in violence. But, I mean, I think we have to start having authentic conversations. And it has to come from the people in the trenches.
And thanks again for joining us, Lisa.
Thank you. There's one more thing I'd like to say. I know in Chicago you just had the mayor release a press release saying they're going to hire 1,000 police officers. I challenge the citizens of Chicago and any city when that happens. It happened in L.A. when I was a background investigator to hold them accountable for the kind of police officers they hire. You can't have them lowering the hiring standards and making concessions just to generate warm bodies in the academy, because when we do that, we see the uptick in violence at and by the police.
There's so much more to talk about. We'll stay in touch. I look forward to seeing your film. And again, I've had Lisa Campbell in the studio. She's served 20 years in law enforcement and comes from a family in which her mother, father, and brother, uncles, and cousins are police officers. She has worked in jails, courts, and the streets and has worked investigations and conducted background investigations for the Los Angeles Police Department. She was born and raised on the south side of Chicago and grew up in a culture infested with gangs and gang violence and offers a unique and raw perspective on the political impact on policing. She has just finished a film called Shoot, Don't Shoot, a documentary that attempts to bridge the gap by addressing the underlying issues that have led to the escalation of violence by and against the police in urban communities like Chicago. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, scroll down the right-hand side, and sign up for iTunes Podcast. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.